Joshua Rupinazai and just come up.
Okay, we are on page 100. Last week we started the Akeda, but Rashi's rather effusive here, so we didn't get so far. And we're actually in the middle of Pasuk Beis. Once Rav Shach was in the Beis Medrash, and somebody came into the Beis Medrash, and Panovich has a very big Beis Medrash, the person was crying and yelling, super upset. And Rav Shach pulled him over and spoke with him for a few minutes, and then the person left. And then the next day, he came in, and he was totally calm, and everything was okay. And when Rav Shach turned to some of the Bachram there, and he said, "Do you know what happened to this man? Like, why yesterday he was upset, and today he's not?" They said, "Why?" He said, "It was a day. A day passed, and now he's not so upset anymore about whatever it was." So that's what is going on here a little bit. Let's read again Pasuk Beis. Vayomer Hashem said to Avraham, Kachnas binchas yechidcha, take your son, your only son, Asher Ahavta, which you love, Es Yitzchak, v'lech lecha Eretz Maria, and go to Eretz Maria, v'halehu sham, and bring him up there, la'ola, for a korban ola, Al achad ha'horim, on one of the mountains, Asher Omar Eilecha, which I will say to you. Hashem doesn't identify it right away. He's going to identify it later. So if you look at Rashi here, Rashi, about two-thirds of the way down in the first column on the right, Es Bincha, your son, Amar Lo, Avram said to Hashem said, take your son. And Avram said back to him, Shnei Banim Yeshli, what do you mean? I have two sons. Who are you talking about? So Amar Lo, Es Yechidcha, like your unique son. So Amar Lo, Avram said to him, Zeh Yachid Leimo, Zeh Yachid Leimo. You know, each one has their own mother. They're each unique in their own way. So Amar Lo, Asher Ahavta, the one that you love. So Amar Lo, Avram responded to him, Shnei Mani Ohev, what do you mean? I love both my sons. So Amar Lo, that's when Hashem finally said to him, Es Yitzchak, take Yitzchak. Why didn't Hashem start with Yitzchak? Why go through this whole rigmarole, like sort of running his way down? Shalo larbavo pisom. In order not to get him too, irbuf hadas is when your mind is thrown into something and it gets all mixed up because you weren't expecting it. Pisom, suddenly, v'tizuk daitolav, and his head would like leave him, like his das would leave, v'titaref, and would be snatched away. So in order to prevent that emotional reaction where a very drastic thing is told to you just without warning, so Hashem led him through this process where he gradually emotionally acclimated himself to the message that Hashem was going to tell him. The Sichos Moser of Chaim Shmulevitz Atzal points out here that obviously this is in stark distinction to what happened to Sarah. We haven't seen that yet, but in the next parsha, it's going to say that Sarah actually dies as a result of being informed about the Akedah, that she was told Avram took Yitzchak to sacrifice him, and without forewarning, she was just told that, and she died right away. So Rabbi Chaim Shalavitz says, you see the importance here of, on one hand, of emotionally acclimating people to certain truths. You can't just expect people to hear something. You have to lead them into it slowly. the Gemara in Kesubas on Samach Bey says there was a incident with Rabbi Chanina ben Chaki Noi, who in those days, today obviously we don't do it, we have a different sociological setup for better or for worse, but the when people used to go to learn Torah in those days, they would leave their families for a number of years. And it was expected that the very great scholars, meaning those who had tremendous potential, and there weren't so many of them, in order to realize their potential, they had to be away without the pressures of family, and not just the pressures, but the distraction, so to speak, of family and everything that entails, because you can't dance at two weddings. You have to be here, you have to be there. And if you're in both, you're in neither. So in order to develop as true Torah scholars, they had to seclude themselves in the Beis Medrash. And it was often for years at a time, like for 5, 7, 8, 10, 12 years even. So the Gemara records an incident with Rabbi Chanina that he came home after this 12-year absence from his home, and he came into the house like ready to, the party's ready, I'm home. But he walked in, and his wife saw him, and the Gemara says, like, she emotionally sensed him before she saw him. There was no acclamation to the fact that all of a sudden he wasn't there for 12 years, and now he is, and she just died. Her heart gave way when he walked in. But then he davened, saying, Hashem, it's not fair. People are going to say it's because of the Torah, it's because of this, because of that. It's not right. And Hashem made an ace and brought her back to life. But the fact is that if you walk in without knocking, right, without sending a letter first or texting, then bad things can happen. The Gemara in Sota, also Chaim Shmulevitz says, we see from when Yaakov died, the brothers, the Shvatim, his children, brought him to be buried in Maris HaMachpelah. And when they got there, Esav was blocking the door. And he said, no, that really the burial plot, it was the last burial plot there, it's meant for Esav. It's not meant for Yaakov, because Esav was the Bechor, he was the firstborn, therefore he's entitled to the burial plot. So they said, what do you mean? You sold it to Yaakov, to our father. He said, what are you talking about? You have a document saying such a thing? They said, we do have such a document, but we didn't bring it with us. We didn't think anybody would be causing trouble. He said, go get it. Let me see what you're talking about. So it was a whole conversation. And they sent somebody to go and retrieve the documentation. Meanwhile, Shevet Dan, the one of the brothers, he had a child, Chushim, who was deaf, and he didn't know what was going on. The Medrash says that he saw Esav was there blocking them, and Yaakov's body was lying there in disgrace, really. Like, Esav wasn't allowing him in, and he couldn't hear what the whole back and forth was. For him, it was just Esav's blocking. There's nothing to talk about. He's obviously being Esav, being the bad man that he is, and he took matters in his own hands. He pulled out his sword. He killed Esav right there. That's how Esav died, was by Chushim ben Don. And so Chaim Shmulevitz says the other brothers didn't have that innate response, because there was a conversation. Esav said, what are you doing? And what about this? What about that? It blunted their emotional response to Esav, because he intellectualized it. Chushim ben Don, who was deaf and didn't hear any of the conversation, didn't have that issue. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says that we have to, what's the takeaway for our own lives is actually in the opposite direction. A lot of times we are inspired to do something. Occasionally a person in life, they have an inspiration, they're going to be better. But we know that a day can go by and you lose your inspiration, right? You're going to be a better child, a better parent, a better spouse, a better whatever it is. You're going to learn more. You're going to do mitzvahs better. You're going to daven better. You're very inspired. At the time you're inspired, you can't imagine not being inspired. But intellectually we know it's not going to happen, right? Tomorrow you're going to be the same old whoever you were, and the inspiration is gone. So that being the case, we see that in the Gemara, David HaMelech had a fraught relationship with Shaul. Before David became king, he was like a famous warrior, let's say, and Shaul HaMelech, who was a righteous person, he promised at a certain point, whoever, leads his wars successfully will get to marry his daughter, and he had two daughters. He had a daughter, Merav, and a daughter, Michal. And David led the war. He was successful. He was married to Michal. But Shaul said he wasn't, and without getting into the details, whether or not David was married to Michal was really dependent on a very, let's say, detail-oriented machlokas in the laws of Kedushin, which we're not going to get into right now. But David thought he definitely was married to Michal. In fact, almost everybody thought he was married to Michal, meaning that's how they paskened. And Shaul was sort of like holding the fort to say, no, David's not married. So much so that Shaul actually married Michal to somebody else, to somebody called Palti ben Lish. But Palti ben Lish knew that this wasn't a good situation, that he believed, like David and the other Rabbanim, that Michal was married to David, which now means that Palti ben Lish was forced into like an intimate situation with somebody who's married to another person, which can't be. So he knew that was bad news. So the Gemara says he stuck a sword into the bed in between them, like the bed that they shared. He said, whoever passes this sword should be impaled upon the sword. He very much wanted to prevent himself from doing anything. So Reb Chaim Shlomovitz points out, the kind of person who'd be willing to do that, who'd be willing to put a sword in the bed, most probably doesn't need a sword to keep you from doing anything. But he said it's not true. That human nature is that our emotions get blunted, our truths get blunted. As the days pass, we adapt and we acclimate. And what seemed so serious before, now it's not such a big deal. So Palti ben Lish knew that was going to happen to him. He understood that his momentary, you know, starkeit, that his sense of importance of what the lines he couldn't cross would eventually be blurred. And in order to prevent that from happening, he put the physical sign of a sword in the bed to make sure he always remembered that which he was supposed to do and not fall to his own personal human nature. If we continue in Rashi here, if we go to the second column, three lines down, Vahalehu, Hashem told Avram to bring him up as a korbanola. So Vahalehu Shem, Lo Amar Lo Shachtuhu. What's interesting, Rashi says, is that Hashem never told him to actually kill him. He just said, bring him up as a korban, meaning bring him up on the altar. It never says anywhere to Shacht Yitzchak. Why? Hashem never intended that Yitzchak should be shechted. He just meant that he should be brought up on the mountain, with the intention of making him a sacrifice, a korban ola. And in fact, that's what happened. Once Avram brought Yitzchak up, he tied him, he put him on the altar. Amar lo, Hashem said to him, Haridu, okay, take him down now. The words I said to you have been fulfilled. Nobody was lying. You did what I said, and you can take him down.
You said to make him a sacrifice.
Bring him up as a korbanola. Right, bring him up as a sacrifice.
So doesn't that mean, what does sacrifice mean? Doesn't that mean he's to kill him?
So that's a good point. So the Sam Derech, the Chevron Rosh Yeshiva, points out here that Avram had a lot of outs, meaning if he was really interested in not killing Yitzchak, this was an easy argument for him to make, that Hashem, you never actually told me to kill Yitzchak. The fact that Avraham's love for Hashem was so great didn't allow him to reinterpret the simple meaning of God's words. Like you said, when you say bring him up, normally that means kill the person. That's the implication. And certainly that's true. Avram, because he had no negias, no meaning he did not allow his own personal feelings for Yitzchak to influence the way he served Hashem, that caused him to be able to go with the simple meaning of what Hashem asked for him, rather than trying to get out on technicality of doing what Hashem wanted. So, yes. But on the other hand, Hashem's not a liar. So Hashem never told him to kill him. Everybody wins in this story. And then Rashi continues, Echad ha-harem, one of the mountains, but Hashem doesn't clarify which mountain right away. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Masa HaTzadikim, or Masha HaTzadikim, Hashem keeps the tzadikim in suspense, or he delays them. You know, he doesn't say right away what he wants. V'achakach Megala Lahem, and then afterwards, he's going to reveal to them the specifics of what he actually wants. So why does Hashem do that? Why does he keep people in the dark and sort of makes their lives ambiguous? until clarity comes later. It's in order to increase their reward. And we find this in other places as well. V'kein el eretz asher araka, which we did together when Hashem first told to Abraham, Lechacha, you have to leave and you'll go to a land which I will show you. There also Hashem didn't immediately specify where Avram was supposed to be going. V'kein b'yona, and we find similarly b'yona, which you'll tell them something, but I'm not telling you yet what you should be telling them. The part of the idea here is that when we serve Hashem, we are often flippant in the methodology that we use, meaning as long as we achieve the result at the end, then we're happy, which that's great, meaning at least you achieve the result. But for the tzaddikim, they're beyond that level. Every action of theirs, every movement is conscious and conscientious and meaningful. So in order to make that happen, it's not just go somewhere and accomplish X, Y, or Z. If that were to be the case, then we have halachic terminology for that called hachana l'mitzvah. There's the mitzvah itself, the actual doing of the mitzvah, and then there's the preparation for the mitzvah. You know, the prep is necessary, but it's not the mitzvah itself. You're just doing it for the sake of being able to get to the mitzvah, and that's not the same as the mitzvah itself. But when you don't know what the mitzvah is, then the prep itself becomes the mitzvah. Hashem says, go. Go where? I don't know. So I'm not going somewhere. It's no longer a prep. The going itself becomes the mitzvah. Most of us, this is something that only really tzaddikim can handle. Obviously, by and large, most of us, we can't handle ambiguity. Like when we're in places in our lives, we don't know what's happening, which unfortunately is often, right? It makes us crazy. Like, what am I supposed to be doing right now? Which direction am I supposed to be going? But for a tzaddik, he appreciates the gift that Hashem is giving him with that ambiguity, that he's being allowed to live a life where the life itself is meaningful, attains mitzvah status, not just as a preparatory stage for something that's coming down the pike. That being said, even within our own context of every action being meaningful, Hashem rewards for every single action. There's a famous Maisa brought down with the wife of the Vilna Gaon, that she had a very good friend that they used to make the rounds actually and collect tzedakah for various causes. And they were super close to each other. They made a pact that whoever dies first will come to the other in a dream to let that person know what is heaven like. It happened, you know, after a number of years, that it was the friend who had died, and she fulfilled her side of the pact. She came to the Vilna Gaon's wife in a dream, and she said, "I'm here." And the Vilna Gaon's wife said, "Well, no. So tell me, well, what is it like on the other side?" And her friend told her, "I'm not allowed to say. We're not allowed to say what it's like on the other side. However, I can tell you one thing. If you remember, once we were collecting and we went to a certain rich woman to collect money from her. And when we got to our house, she wasn't there. So we had to leave and we started, you know, walking around looking for her, seeing maybe where she could be. And then you saw her on the other side of the street and you pointed to her saying, there she is, let's go collect. And I want you to know that in addition to our mitzvah of collecting, even just the pointing, like literally an insignificant act of pointing, you get rewarded for that as well. That Hashem's justice is to the detail. And every single action a person does gets rewarded, lasalavo, in the future. Let's continue on Pasuk Gimel. Vayashkem Avram Baboker. Abraham woke up in the morning. Vayachvosh es chamoro. He saddled his donkey. Vayikach eshnina arv ito. He took his two young men with him. Veis Yitzchak beno, and he took Yitzchak as well, obviously. Vayivaka atze ola, and he split wood for the korban, for the korban ola. Vayakam, and he got up, vayelach, and he went el hamakam asher amalo halokim, to the place where Hashem told him. Let's look at Rashi Gimel in the middle of the second column. Gimel, Vayashkem. He got up early. Vayashkem always has that connotation of somebody getting up very early, more than you would think that they should have to get up. And Rashi explains, Nizdares l'mitzvah. He had zrizus for the mitzvah. He had zrizus means when you move to accomplish something quickly. You don't delay it in any way. So he was so pumped to do this mitzvah, Avraham, that he was jumping out of bed like earlier than he should have in order to accomplish this mitzvah. Now,
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
You said he was pumped to do this mitzvah. Is he thinking or knowing that the mitzvah is going to be to sacrifice Isaac?
That's what he thinks, yes.
That's what he thinks. And he is pumped to do it.
Yes. Meaning, that's what we're saying. His obeisance, his appreciation, his ava for Hashem was so overwhelming that Hashem said, so then, of course, that's the right thing to do. Now, the Medrash does say he wasn't able to totally... surpass his humanity. And that when he was actually by the Mizbeach with Yitzchak on the Mizbeach, that tears dripped from his eyes as he was about to kill him. And there were ramifications for those tears. But if a person's clear thinking, and we'll hopefully discuss this a little bit later, then everything Hashem does is for the good. And the same way we are happy. I mean, we don't want to be in a situation where we need to provide, let's say, medical treatment for a child. If Chas V'Shalom, somebody is in that situation, they'll be very, and they know that the treatment's going to work, they'll be happy to get the child to that treatment, even if it means there's going to be pain involved in the procedure, things like that. They know ultimately it's the ultimate good. So they'll be ready to go. They're not going to be schlepping along to help save their child. So here, yes, obviously the Yitzchak was supposed to die, but in the greater scheme of things, it was the ultimate good because Hashem said so. And he didn't understand why. We don't understand. I mean, we're able to see that it was only a test, but for Avram, that perhaps was the major part of the Nisayon, is not being able to understand why, meaning knowing it was for the good, but not understanding how it was for the good. This is not a test that we have to deal with, fortunately. This was something on Avram's level that Hashem decided to test him.
But also he knew that, like I asked last week, you know, he was supposed to be the father of a great nation, and it would be through Yitzhak, right? Because he already had him,
yes,
when he was old.
Yes.
So maybe on the back of the mind, right, something, right?
Rashi actually is going to address that. Let me see if we skipped it or not. I think he's going to address it later. He's going to mention that fact that both things were playing out at the same time. Yeah, and how they interacted. So the concept of zrizus, which is a famous concept we teach children about in school all the time. The Gemara says zrizim makdim la mitzvos, that those who are zaris, those who are, there's no good English word for it, but that they get going. They don't tarry. They don't delay, and they make things happen quickly. That is a fundamental concept as by mitzvos, where all our mitzvos are supposed to be done with zrizos, that they're supposed to be done with a bren, with an excitement, with a push, and not like, oh, okay, fine, I'll do it, and you know, schlep your feet till it actually gets done. It's right. So it's not supposed to be like the household chores that especially post Pesach that your wife asks you to do, as you're just trying to calm down a little bit from having 20 people in the house or whatever. So it's, I thought you were bringing up the bed. I know. So no, it's supposed to be a zrizos. You're supposed an energy.
Basic
power,
right?
So what's going on there? So the This actually finds its makor in Hilchos Pesach. The source for this halacha, or this attitude towards halacha, that every mitzvah should be done with zrizos, with a bran, is from the pasuk Shmartim Es HaMatzos, right? Everybody knows about matzah, shmur matzah, that it has to be guarded in a certain way during the production process, during either from the time it's harvested, the time that you actually grind the kernels, depending on which opinion, what you're trying to accomplish. And then, of course, we watch it throughout the process to make sure it doesn't become chametz. But that pasuk, Shmartim Es HaMatzos, so the Medrash says on that, Al Tikri Matzos El Mitzvos, that you don't read, you should guard the matzos, but rather you should guard the mitzvos. It's spelled in the same way. And the Medrash darshens out from there, mitzvah, bal yadcha, if a mitzvah comes to your hand, al tach mitzana. Don't let it become chametz. Don't like allow it to tarry, to delay, and rather just do it right away. The Maharal says when you delay a mitzvah, the problem is you're showing, and this is his language, that it's nofal tachas hazman, that it's falling within the framework of time. And by showing that, by delaying, and that thus making it subject to the passage of time, it's a pagam, it's a defect in the mitzvah. You still get the mitzvah, even if you didn't do it with zrizos, but it's defective in a certain way. And he doesn't explain too much. So Rav Huttner Zatzal, and Pachan Yitzhak, he explains further what is the morale talking about, that Pasuk in Kohelet says, HaNefesh lo samale, that the nefesh cannot be filled up, that when you live in our world, in our physical world, the nefesh will never be filled up. So what the soul will never be filled up. The Medrash in Kohelet there gives a mashal that when a princess marries, you know, a commoner, a villager, no matter what he brings her, she's never going to be happy. Like whatever flowers he's bringing her, whatever candy he's bringing her, whatever, you know, things for the house he's bringing her, she knows better. There's nothing he can bring her that will ever satisfy her in any kind of way whatsoever. Zman, the concept of time, Rav Huttner says, it's, and this is famous in the Rishonim, is itself a creation, right? We don't think about it that way because time just flows for us without our sensing, you know, a metzias, a reality to time, but time itself is a creation. Before the world was created, there was no such thing as time. There was just an infinite now, meaning God knows the before, he knows the after, he knows the present. For him, there is no distinction of time. Everything is just current, as it were, meaning the past and the future at the same time. Time is a artificial construction that allows us to have bechira, free will, because now we can make choices. It's not everything happening all at once, but we have an A and then we move to B and to C, and that allows our paths to diverge and we can make choices and whatnot. But really, from God's perspective, the whole notion of time doesn't exist. From a spiritual perspective, the notion of time doesn't exist. So he says that time for the nefesh, for the neshama of a person, the soul of a person, time is the villager, so to speak. That the neshama wants to be close to Hashem. It wants to be connected to Hashem, but it's married to a goof, a physical body, which is bound in all these ways, including bound by time. When the neshama finally gets a chance to engage in a mitzvah, which is Hashem saying, here's a vehicle, a venue via which you can now connect with me. The neshama has this ability to reconnect with a Kaddish Baruch Hu, but it's done within the framework of time. So the neshama is like yelling, screaming that, please let me free, and I want to do this mitzvah and connect 100%, but unfortunately, it's bound to the physicality in this world. And because of that, it's held back to a certain extent. But the neshama can still make a gesture that it wishes it wouldn't be bound by that physicality. And that gesture is zrizus, that when it moves to do the mitzvah quickly, to show that I prefer the time not being here, I want everything to be happening in the infinite, instantaneous now, then that shows the neshama's, you know, embrace of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Ruchnius, spirituality, and its disdain for the physical situation it finds itself in, specifically that of being bound by time. So that's what Zrizus actually is. For Avra, when we do say Zrizim Makdim La Mitzvos, that we should try to be Zariz when we do mitzvos, we should try to do things quickly. That's the philosophical idea behind it. For Avraham, it was innate, it was intuitive, meaning Avram already was on a level where of course he was zaris for mitzvahs. It was a natural response. For most of us, though, we unfortunately, obviously, hopefully we will someday have a natural response as rizas, but usually it's the other way. We do have to push ourselves to do mitzvahs. But that's okay. It should still be done with zrizas, as the Mesilas Yesharim says, when you, you know, fake it till you make it, basically, that if you behave in a way which has zrizas in it, you'll be training yourself to be that kind of person, meaning you're establishing the pathways, even on a spiritual level, that you will then be tapping into. So if you are zaris, even though you don't feel it, eventually that will become your personality. You'll have that sensitivity to mitzvahs where you'll innately want the connection and you know, transcend all the barriers that are preventing you.
Right, but this is a different mitzvah. Most of us would not be in a hurry to take our child to sacrifice.
That's true. And that's
none
why
of us. I mean, this is
that's why Hashem never gave us that Nisayon. This was unique to Avraham. It was not something that was even to the other great people in Tanakh, like to Moshe Rabbeinu, Yaakov, Yitzchak, etc. They didn't have this Nisayon. Avraham was on a level where his appreciation for the infinite good that Hashem was able to overcome all his, you know, superficial understandings of the world, including the organic love he felt for his son. That being said, the nisyonos we do get, the test that you and I get, that Hashem delivers to us on a daily basis, we are expected to pass, though. And we can understand how, for the most part, almost every daily situation we find ourselves in, we can say, you know what, it would be better if I could do this, you know, with excitement or happiness. But you're right, it was an incomprehensible nisayon, and it was the illogic of the nisayon that was really testing Avraham, because if somebody's already on the level where they've basically transcended everything else, the only thing you'll be able to test them with is a contradiction. But we're not anywhere near that. I mean, you know, hopefully we'll get to there, but we're not, Hashem would never test us in that kind of situation.
Rabbi, I'm not familiar with the word that you've been using, zrizos.
Zrizos.
Can you spell that in Hebrew for me? I'm going to look it up later.
That's okay. So in the Rashi we read, by Gimel Vayashkem, it said, the first word Rashi says is nizdares. You see, five lines up from the bottom there, Vayashkem, Rashi yes. Says Nizdares. The Shorish is Zion Resh Zion. So to be Zariz is to be quick, to do something with, energy.
Thank you.
So Lenny, in Hebrew, it's used a lot.
Okay.
Tizdares, get going.
Yeah, okay.
yeah. So let's continue in the in the Rashi. Let's see, where are we? Yeah. So the next Rashi, meaning the same line, Rashi says Vayachvosh, and he saddled his donkey. So hu ba'atzmo, Avram himself did it. V'lod siva echad me'avadav. He didn't command any of his servants to saddle the donkey for him. Why? Shahava mekalkel sashura, because love destroys a person's sense of normalcy, or what's proper and what's right. Love can make a person do weird things. So that's quoting Bereshis Rabba. That's quoting the Medrash. The Rav Yerucham here says that this is actually Chazal are pointing out something that's negative about Avram here. That we would think it's just positive. He so much wanted to fulfill Hashem's commandment, he was willing even to saddle the donkey himself. So that's not true. We don't allow ourselves to be lost in an emotion, or we're not supposed to. We're not supposed to be emotionally driven like that. We're supposed to think, what does Hashem want in any given situation, and allow that to be our guiding light. It's hard to hear in today's generation, but the Torah very much embraces a conception of kavod, of honor and worthiness. And it's not everything's equal. Not everything is the same. Intuitively we know this. We just it's hard to fight the public perception about it. But if you have the president who's supposed to be involved in making very high level decisions, and then you're giving him like the Excel spreadsheets to reconcile the accounting for the White House, that's not his job. He shouldn't be doing that. He has much more important things to do. It's almost denigrating to him if he's stuck doing the paperwork on everything. Similarly, if a person is engaged, we don't have the rabbi, mopping the floor, because we understand that that's not his job. That would be beneath him. Even if he volunteers, we should have a sense. No, what are you talking about? You go and learn that. You do much more important work. Any of us can mop the floor, but we're not you. You have to be the one who's elevating us. So that conception of understanding one's place and what's expected of them, you're not allowed to debase yourself and do things that really are below your station. And it's not like in a conceited, like English, Victorian kind of way, below your station, but in a human, spiritual kind of way. Hashem created people, and people themselves shouldn't debase themselves in certain ways, and elevated people can't even debase themselves in ways that for other people might be a mitzvah to do so. If it's for the service of God, that's one thing. And we do find that for mitzvahs that involve honoring others, be it HaKadosh Baruch Hu or parents or things like that, the great rabbis of the Talmud did debase themselves. Like when it came, there's a mitzvah to honor Shabbos. So the Gemara tells us that each rabbi had his own thing which he would do to honor Shabbos. He would peel the potatoes, or he would, whatever it was. It was plebeian work, but he was doing it with Kavod Shabbos. So the fact that it was a mitzvah of Kavod, of honoring, itself, like, it caused the debasement to be transcended into something holy. Similarly, the Gemara talks about the way they handled their parents, that there's a mitzvah of honoring one's parents. So one of the Tanaim, it says, when it was raining outside, he used to actually lie on the ground so his mother could walk on him so her feet wouldn't get muddy. It wasn't in any circumstance, obviously that would be incredibly debasing, but when it's for the mitzvah of kavod, in this case for one's parents, it transcends. But standard, a person has to understand who they are and what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing. And when a person's caught up by their emotions, though, it's problematic, because then you lose your sense of respectability, a divine respectability, and you find yourself doing things that normally you would have thought you wouldn't have been able to do or would have never considered doing. So that's the complaint on Avram here. His ava for Hashem was so overwhelming, which obviously is a very good thing, but it led him to debase himself in certain ways which he shouldn't have, like, for instance, saddling his donkey himself. This was said also in other contexts. Obviously, Rav Kook Zatzal was known for his great love of the Jewish people and his approach to the Chilonim in Eretz Yisrael, to the irreligious in Eretz Yisrael, was one of embrace and love and warmth and partnership in certain ways that Kemat, all the rest of the Torah world did not endorse, meaning all the other great leaders of the generation argued with Rav Kook on that idea. And the Torah tells us how to interact with those who are not religious. And there are pretty strict rules about it. There are times for love, and everything has to be done, of course, from a perspective of love, but there's also a great distancing which has to take place. The Torah feels that if you just allow it to be unrequited love, not unrequited, but unmitigated love, that and it's just all out there and a full embrace, then you're going to have some influence on them, but they'll also have some influence on you, and we're not willing to risk that. We don't want the negative influence from an irreligious world to affect those who are Torah true. So there are boundaries, there are guidelines, and the other Gedolim felt, the Rav Kook, often, crossed over those boundaries, but the Ger Rebbe, obviously one of the great tzaddikim at that time, he said, Rav Kook, he applied this this messaging of Rashi to Rav Kook, that Avasol Mekalkelos HaShashura, that his great love ruined his sense of boundary. Because he loved Yidden so much, it led him to embrace them in ways that really were not appropriate, that were not halachically sanctioned, but it was all a result of his great love for Yidden. And therefore, it not that we would do it, but we can excuse it because of the source from where it was coming. If we continue in the psukim, you know, this is going to be a little bit longer. Maybe we'll stop here and we'll pick up Yisr Hashem next week with Pasuk Daled.
Doesn't Chabad embrace everything?
But they still have boundaries. Like if you go to a Seder, their wine will be in paper bags, so the irreligious won't look at it. They're not. You can ask Chabad, but I'm not going to.
Just to get my opinion, yeah. My humble, very humble.
Yeah.